This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, my name is Sue and you're listening to Hear Me Roar. Marty Keel explores the underlying worldview of nature ethics, offering an alternative eco-feminist approach, seeking to heal the divisions between the seemingly disparate movements and philosophies of feminism, animal advocacy, environmental ethics and holistic health. Welcome, Marty.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Have you been to Melbourne before?
My first trip.
Really?
First trip here. I'm very much enjoying it.
Wow. Do you find it very different to your hometown?
Well, it's certainly colder.
Oh, I know. Wrong time to visit.
Yes, but the people are wonderful. You've got a beautiful city here.
It is a beautiful
love
city.
Love the botanical gardens.
Oh, well, you would, actually.
Yes.
It is a beautiful city. Are you here lecturing on your new
book? I came to Australia to attend a conference called Minding Animals in Newcastle, and I had some extra time, and so I thought I need to see a little bit more of Australia. So I went to Sydney, and then I came here.
Well, thank you for coming, and certainly thank you for coming in to Joy 94.9. Marty, why did you write Nature Ethics, an Eco-Feminist Perspective, and what do you hope it will accomplish?
I wrote Nature Ethics because of my concern with a major failing within the environmental movement and within environmental philosophy, and because I came to believe that an ecofeminist analysis could help shed light on that problem and point to a way toward resolving it. And the problem that I saw was that there was an increasing focus on species, the ecosystem, or larger abstract constructs, and the idea that they needed to be managed through scientific management, and a lack of concern for individual beings, a lack of validation of empathy for the individual animals that live within these constructs. And I came to believe that we needed to understand these problems through a gendered analysis, through understanding the role of masculine identity and how that influences these attitudes.
Are you getting any feedback about the fact that you do define masculinity within your work?
Yes, I think there's always some people that say it's divisive to talk about gender differences or a gendered aspect to a problem. You always get that response, certainly from some men, but also from some women. But my feeling is that we need to understand that I'm not creating these problems. There are gender differences, and when you look across the board, there are gender differences in violence. We know that 90% of violent crime is committed by men, and what we're finding is that these same differences apply to attitudes towards wildlife, towards nature, and that the social ecologist Stephen Kellert has shown that gender is the major demographic factor that influences attitudes towards wildlife, that there's much more opposition among women to cruelty, much more support of dominionistic attitudes among men, much more support of what he calls humanistic attitudes among women. So these differences do exist, and they certainly have existed in the animal advocacy movement, which was always spearheaded by women. Women have really been the backbone of the movement from its inception.
It's really interesting. And from reading what you've written, or some of what you've written, the hunting aspect, looking at the historical perspective of hunting and the relationship of men within that hunting and patriarchal society. Could you explain a bit more about that?
Well, hunting is something that has interested me a lot because I think it really brings out the gendered aspect. We know that throughout history, throughout the world, that hunting has been associated with men, that men are predominantly the ones who hunt. And we know that it is considered throughout many cultures of the world a prototypical rite of entry into masculine identity. And what it does symbolically is that it signifies that the young boy goes out and kills an animal and shows that he is no longer associated with the female animal world, the female-imaged animal world, that he is now bonded with a community of men, and that he's denying his feelings of connection with other living beings. And one of the things that interested me the most about hunting is that it was so central in the United States and in other countries with the early conservation movement. And there was this idea that people think, oh, the conservation movement was about conserving animals, and there was this understanding that they were running out of animals and they wanted to protect them. But what they were really concerned with primarily was that they were losing the opportunity to go out and demonstrate their masculine identity, that if they killed off all the animals, there would be no animals left to go out and have these rites of entry into manhood. It was central. You know, we have to remember this was the 19th century. It was the time of Darwin's philosophy coming into prominence. And there was this idea that finally, you know, this recognition that humans are animals, and in particular, men and young boys. So we had this idea that, you know, women had this civilizing effect on men, but they also, there was this concern that they were becoming overly effeminate.
So they had to go out and hunt.
They had to go out and have their rites of entry into manhood. And it was central. It was central to Theodore Roosevelt's philosophy and to Aldo Leopold. And anyone who studies environmental philosophy, you hear the name Aldo Leopold and everyone wants to bow down, you know, father of the environmental movement, environmental philosophy. And he did have a major influence, but it was very much about this idea of hunting being central and ethics being the restraint of the natural aggression within men. So, and that's one of the things that I critique within my book, within Nature Ethics. I critique this idea of ethics as a form of restraint. That's been a major idea within our religious and philosophical traditions, that you lust after these things that are bad for you, or that
well, we do,
but that the solution to it, you know, this these aggressive impulses, that, you know, this, there's this idea we naturally have these aggressive impulses, and the solution is to just restrain them. And that's where the hunting rules and regulations came in. There was this idea that sport hunting was superior to mere subsistence hunting, like those, you know, Native Americans did, mm-hmm. and, you know, or the commercial and subsistence hunters. And there was this idea that the conservationists were superior because they had rules and regulations.
Like the duck hunting season, basically, you're saying.
Yeah, the seasons and the times of day and the number of animals killed, and somehow that makes it okay.
Makes it okay.
And I think that, you know, a lot of our ethical theories function in similar ways. You know, that, you know, you regulate violence and somehow it's okay, but it's not.
It's absolutely not okay. How does that relate then to feminism?
Well, one of the things that I look at in my feminist analysis, which really is an eco-feminist analysis, is that the domination of external nature is intimately connected to the domination of our internal nature. So that the feelings that we have are associated with the natural world. And this whole idea that feelings of connection with other living beings, feelings of empathy, are somehow to be devalued, I think is very much a patriarchal mindset. And a lot of ecofeminists are trying to discuss this idea of an ecofeminist ethic of care. And that affirms our connection with other living beings. We're not separate. We're all interconnected. Just because we're born into a human body doesn't make us somehow superior to another living being.
No, so, absolutely not. What are then the key elements of the philosophy other than what you've already gone through?
Well, I think my ecofeminist analysis basically looks at the commonalities and the devaluation of women in nature under patriarchal society. And The term was coined in 1973 by a French woman named Françoise Daubonne.
And it's a beautiful name.
It is a beautiful name. And it really, she was looking at the similar worldview that underlies the domination of women in nature.
And historically through our traditions. For instance, yes. The marriage ceremony, I was reading what you wrote about the handing over of from the father as a as an object, the daughter, to then the son-in-law to be. And I didn't actually see it like that. I thought, oh, it's nice. You know, there you go, darling. And when I read it, I thought, oh, goodness.
It's property. It's property. Yeah. Mm. Well, Simone de Beauvoir had a very important concept that a lot of, you know, ecofeminists have talked about and feminists more generally. And it's this idea of women as the other. And what's important to understand about the concept of the other, it's not just another. There's this idea that men are the norm and women are the other. And what's interesting about that concept is that when you look at psychological theory, which is something that interests me, it's really masculine identity that's conceived as the other, because both the boy and the girl child begin their life through an identification with the mother figure, which traditionally is the primary caretaker. But at a certain point in time, the boy child needs to deny his connection, not just with the mother, but with all of the female world.
You have to be a man, son.
Yeah, and what is a man? He's not a woman. Mm. He's opposed. There's this oppositional construction.
He can't cry. He can't
show emotion. Cry. He needs to suppress his feelings of empathy. I think that has been a very important core concept. And in ecofeminist philosophy, a lot of women are looking at a whole series of dualisms that are connected to that notion of women as the other. So you have reason, emotion, you have conscious, unconscious, autonomous, dependent, you have good, evil, you have this concept of a sky god that is above the earth, that rules over the earth.
So strong and weak, basically, it comes down to, doesn't it?
Yeah,
on the
and superior,
umbrella.
Inferior, male, female. Mm. And then how that functions is that the inferior part of the dualism exists to serve the needs of the superior. And so there's a real sense in which women and nature become objects that exist to serve the superior needs of men.
And the basics of that is food, shelter, warmth, slavery.
Yeah, sexual access or reproductive access. And, you know, that's very much a part of it. And that's, you know, the whole idea of the marriage ceremony, which the woman is symbolically given over to the husband or her new owner.
Nice.
And it's not insignificant that the same terminology is used in this animal husbandry. There's this idea that men are the controllers of the reproductive capacity of animals. So the ecofeminist analysis of these dualistic worldviews is an important part of ecofeminist philosophy, but also contextualizing things. So instead of seeing more moral dilemmas as this abstract contemplation of, you know, understanding the obligations and rights based on an understanding of the beings that you're making your moral decisions about. It's understanding the context within which moral decisions arise.
On a more ethical level.
Yeah, yeah. So instead of just saying somebody's sick, do we give them some drugs that have been experimented on animals. Now let's try to find out why the person is sick to begin with, and let's have a wider perspective that understands the worldview that says that it's okay to use another living being to experiment on to resolve the problems of another living being. So you understand the context. And again, a lot of ecofeminists have talked about an ethic of care. And I think that's also a very important aspect of an ecofeminist philosophy. A lot of ecofeminists talked about the act of attention, There's a philosopher named Iris Murdoch who says if you direct a patient loving regard upon a person, place, or situation, you will know what to do when the situation arises. So that's a very different way of conceiving morality.
Can you describe why you feel that veganism is a feminist issue as opposed to vegetarianism? There's that kind of next level up, isn't there?
Yes, I do feel that it's a very important issue for feminists and for ecofeminists. And I think it comes down to understanding where our food comes from and what we are supporting by making the choices that we make when we consume animal products. And animal products come with a tremendous amount of suffering. And when you look at the worldview that supports it, it really is a very patriarchal worldview that says there this living being exists solely to provide flesh or solely to provide their products for our well-being. And if you look at dairy cows, for instance, they're based on the severing of the mother-infant bond, which is the strongest bond in nature. And there it says that, no, this milk that was perfectly designed for your infant is not for your infant, it's for us.
Mm.
And we're going to take that. And, you know, the mother cow and the calf cry for days in anguish. This is, a very, anguishing experience for both of them. And the cows are kept in a continual state of lactation. They're pumped full of hormones. And then, of course, the young male calves are sold into the veal industry, where they live in 2x5 stalls for their entire life.
It is disgraceful. I am a vegetarian, so.
So it's complete control of the reproductive capacity of animals. And in the United States, it's largely moving in the direction of artificial insemination. So in the United States, 85% of sows are artificially inseminated and 66% of dairy cows. And so it's really a rape culture. And for feminists to be supporting a rape culture just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Can I quote you? You've said, what happens outside the realm of humanity where we do not speak the language of those with whom we interact? How do we engage in dialogues with earthworms, snails and plants? And I think that again relates to the cows and the sheep and everything in the
yes, you know, industry. We have this idea that we're the only ones who have language. Well, we don't speak the language of the rest of nature, and we don't make an attempt to understand other living beings, and I think we really need to. And I think nature is speaking to us. You know, global warming and all the things that are going wrong in nature are signs to us that something is deeply wrong with the way we treat the natural world, and we do need to change our attitudes and practices.
As a human race, we do abuse the earth, and we do abuse animals. We even abuse other people.
Absolutely. and I should emphasize that ecofeminists very much make those connections. You know, that is an important part of ecofeminist analysis, is to see how the domination of women is connected to the domination of people of color, the domination of people due to their sexual orientation. It's all part of this dualistic worldview that sees us and the other.
As we're the minority. Can you tell me about the division between animal rights movements and the environment movement?
Well, that really is a very central issue that I'm looking at in nature ethics, and I think it's a major problem, because with this focus on species or the ecosystem, there really isn't this concern for individual beings. And so none of the major environmental organizations oppose hunting. None see a problem with animal experimentation. In fact, a lot of them will cite animal experiments as a reason for not putting certain chemicals into the environment.
That's a different perspective than we're getting from the general community. We're actually getting the perspective that they're fighting for the rights of these animals. And is that actually an incorrect perception?
It's correct, but what gets obfuscated is that they're really looking at animals as an aggregate construct. They're not looking at individual beings. So they won't have any problem with preserving animals in zoos if that's necessary to propagate the species, even if some of them, the offspring, gets sold to animal experiments or whatever. And there's a real sense in which conservation has become a form of reproductive control. And it goes back to this biblical notion of, you know, be fruitful and replenish the earth, and that this idea that humans are given dominion over the earth. And so a number of theologians are trying to reinterpret the concept of dominion and say it's about stewardship. But my concern is that it's still a form of management and control. There's this idea that God selects one species out of all the millions on the planet, says, you're it, you're in charge, you control the planet. And I think that's really the mentality that has gotten us into the problems we're in to begin with. We need to get away from that idea that somehow we're outside of nature and somehow superior and in a position to control the whole show.
And certainly, I guess that relates into the Aboriginal culture here within Australia. They had it right. Whereas we've come in and we've dominated animals, we've dominated the earth, we haven't recycled properly. We've basically used and discarded in our own backyard.
Yeah, yes. As Barbara Ehrenreich says, we're the only species that soils our own nest.
Mm. I think it doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
Can you tell me more about the organisation, Peter? Now, they've done advertising campaigns with naked women. Do you think that's helped the cause?
I actually don't. I think it's really set our movement back, and I don't want to detract from the good things that PETA has done, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, but I do think that they are employing the same mentality of the mainstream culture, which says that women's naked bodies sell products, and they're just using it to sell the animal rights cause. And I think it's just a basic notion that you don't advance one movement at the expense of the other. And Marshall McLuhan said it years ago, the medium is the message. How you present your cause is very much the message that people get. And I think you are reinforcing the objectification of women. And that's the whole mentality that we need to get away from. We need to be making connections with other movements, not alienating them.
And not having little movements going on all around the place, but actually having a unified force.
Well, I think it's fine to work separately as long as, you know, we can come together around the bigger issues. You know, I think it's also important to say where we have disagreements. And so some people would say, no, you can't criticize PETA. You know, that it's important to support what they do because it means you don't care about animals. You know, a lot of people would say that. And I think, no, you know, you can validate the good things that PETA does and say that this is not the best way to be resolving the oppression of animals.
Now, you've also written about the commonalities in the experience of coming out as a vegetarian or a vegan and coming out as gay. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Sure. What I've just noticed in talking to people that there were many commonalities in the way that people experience their coming out process. And so I think part of it revolves around what I call, what we know we have homophobia, but I think in a real sense there is vegophobia. One of the reasons that people have difficulty in becoming a vegetarian or becoming a vegan is that we live in a meat-dominant world in the same way that we live in a male-dominant world. And Adrienne Rich had a concept of compulsory heterosexuality, and she basically argued that in our culture, heterosexuality is not a choice. That it's something that it is maintained, organized, propagandized by social and cultural and institutional norms that say you must be this, you must conform to this norm. That men must have access to women's bodies. And I think we have a similar concept with animals, you know, that humans must have access to the bodies of animals. and they must have access to animal flesh. And we have a similar idea that somehow that food that doesn't have meat is not complete. It's not a complete meal. So just as somebody would say to a lesbian, well, what do you do? Mm. Somebody would say to a vegetarian, well, what do you eat?
We are subjected to the last part on the menu, and we're always the last add-on. You know, we provide this service and for gay and lesbian, or we offer these meat dishes, and here's the vegetables in plain sauce.
Right, right. Mm. And there's also the idea that you're somehow deviating from what is a norm. So people, will say, you know, what made you gay? Nobody says, you know, what made you heterosexual?
Mm.
In the same way, people will say, well, why are you a vegetarian or why are you a vegan? Nobody thinks to ask, why are you a meat eater?
No.
Why are you eating animal products? And that's one of the things that really interests me is reversing the tables, you know, just standing back and getting people to question their norms and what I call it toppling patriarchy with a fork. Yes. Understanding the things that support them.
Starting
so
at the dinner plate.
Support patriarchy, yes.
Quite often, vegetarians or vegans, gay, lesbian, transgender, intersex, bisexual, we're seen as non-complete.
Yes, I think that's very much a part of it, that somehow a woman who's without a man, for example, is seen as lacking. There's this lack of ability to understand how could she possibly have sexual fulfillment without a man. In the same way, I think vegetarians and even more vegans are seen as somehow deficient, somehow, you know, how do you get your protein? Mm. How do you get your strength? And, you know, even pitied, you know, oh, you can't eat that. You know, people always say, if I go out, you can't eat that. I say, I can eat that. I choose not to.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of deprivation. Somehow you're not complete, that you always need that complement, the animal products, to complete your dietary identity. So sexual identity and dietary identity are very connected.
I think you're right in that there's a constant justification, whether you are a feminist, whether you're a woman, whether you're a lesbian, whether you're a vegetarian, and it can be really exhausting. I don't think others often see that.
Yeah, I think that's the force of meat dominance and male dominance. These are the norms, and you somehow need to explain your dietary identity or your sexual identity. We are the deviates. And that's why I think that community is so important. And I think there's a lot that vegans and vegetarians can learn from the gay movement or the queer movement, whatever you call it. I think that we really need to understand the importance of community, the importance of understanding how difficult it is to transform our dietary identities. And I think that the gay movement has really given us a sense of the importance of community as an important way of coping with them.
Mm, because before you actually mentioned it, I didn't really see the parallels.
Yes, I have one friend who was in college, and he was talking about his friends, and I was saying, well, are they vegetarian? And he said, well, you know, they haven't really come out of the pantry yet.
Now, what are the implications of focusing on a concern for a species or ecosystems over and above the concern for individual animals?
Well, I think that it really illustrates our failure to validate our complete natures, our animal natures, as caring beings that are connected with other animals. And, you know, I think it gets back to this idea of reproductive control. If you're only concerned with species, which actually is a philosophical construct, you can't see, touch, or hear a species, and philosophers do debate whether it really exists. I think, you know, we have, you know, laws about the Endangered Species Act, and they do protect individual animals, and I certainly wouldn't do away with them. But I think we really need to have much more of a focus on empathy and care for individual beings too, because otherwise you're sacrificing individual beings for these larger constructs. you get into this managerial control. And I think we really need to move away from that and rediscover our connection with other individual beings as well.
And as females, we do have that sense of empathy and understanding. We look beyond what's there. We look in.
Yes, I think that there's no doubt that women are more in touch with their empathic natures. And we can debate whether that's by birth or socialization. We know that, you know, there's certainly a lot of socialization in that direction. But that we certainly know that men are socialized to not be in touch with those feelings. And I think that's really what needs to be encouraged.
But not all men are dominating, maniacal beings who want to enslave women. We have a lot of beautiful men in our community.
Absolutely. I think the work that they're doing needs to be validated. And, I think that most of them understand the detrimental effect of masculine identity as a norm. So even though individual men may not conform to that norm, that all men are in relation to that norm. So you can choose not to relate to that. You know, you can, you know, doesn't mean you can rid yourself of all the trappings of it. But, you know, John Stoltenberg talks about refusing to be a man. And of course, he's using the man and the socially constructed sense of the term. And I think that's something that men can do.
Do you come under fire for being a man-hater or an anti-male person?
I certainly have received feedback like that on occasion, but I have to say it's less and less. I think there's more of an understanding. I'm talking about a social construction. It's not about blaming individuals. I just think it's really important that we understand that there is a gender component to violence, and there is a gender component to violence against nature. And if we're just talking about environmental problems in the abstract and not looking at this aspect, I think we're not going to get to the root of it. And I do think we need to start at a very young age, you know, with young children.
And what do you suggest?
I think we need to change the things that are being taught in schools, in the media. I think the whole idea of kindness needs to be taught. We need to make the development of empathy and care for other living beings a central goal of our culture. We have a Department of Justice. Why can't we have a Department of Care? Why can't we have courses on it and teaching people to nurture those feelings of empathy and care?
Do you go through this and so much more in the Nature Ethics book?
I do. I discuss it at length. And I also talk about, I use an ecological model to look at the development of care, because one of the reasons that the ethic of care is so devalued in our culture is that the ethicists say, well, care is something that's fluctuating. Some people have it, some people don't. You don't want to base an ethic on it. Rationality is much more reliable. But of course, you know, we have laws based on reason about, you know, stopping rape. Has that stopped rape? No. And so on the one hand, the reason-based ethics aren't as potent as people claim. And on the other hand, a care ethic, although you can't mandate care, you can cultivate it, you can nourish it, and you can look at the things that are preventing its development. And so that's a big part of my work, is what is preventing the development of empathy and care in our culture? What can we do to nourish it? So it's a different approach to use this holistic paradigm or this ecological paradigm.
Because we do grow up often seeing what we can get out, not what we can put in, even though we do have elements of that. We're taught as children to be nice and to be kind, but we're also taught what you can get out. If you do this, you can get this back. So they're fundamental stepping stones in our growth.
Yes. And I think it also, we're just so influenced by the things around us. We often forget that. We have this idea of choice that, you know, you can choose to do this or you can choose to do that. And, you know, that's why people think vegetarianism or veganism is a choice. And you just think about it and then you make this reason-based choice. But if there are social and institutional factors that are influencing the way you view the world. You're not this autonomous being who's making ethical decisions in an abstraction. You're influenced by the media. You're influenced by your culture. So I think that that is the kind of thing we need to be focusing on. What are the influences that are deadening our feelings of empathy and care? You know, and how can we get in touch with those feelings?
Is there a difference then in Western culture to European culture in this, in looking at our dominance on animals?
You know, I think that the dominance idea is pretty pervasive. I think there are some differences in the East and India and certain other countries, but in terms of use, in terms of this idea of using animals, it's pretty pervasive. You do have within, if you go back to the one of the earliest philosophies, the Jain philosophy, you have this concept of himsa, not causing harm to other living beings, which is a beautiful thought. But historically, I think that idea has been very much tied to ritual purity. So there's this idea that as long as you don't do the killing, then you're pure. You're not implicated in the violence. And so you have very much this idea that you're dominating your internal animal nature, that you're showing your superiority by abstaining from these temptations of the flesh.
Because in Asian culture, the butchers were seen as lower class.
Yeah, that's right, because they were implicated in this violence. And as long as you didn't do it yourself, you had good karma. And, you know, you would not come back as an animal, which was considered a form of punishment.
Now, over the last two decades, have you seen a change in the attitudes in the feminist movement towards animal rights and vegetarianism or veganism?
I do think there's been a change. It's not as much as I would like, but I certainly see a change in consciousness, if not in practice all the time. I remember 20 years ago when I went to, I was telling a woman I was going to an anti-fur demonstration, and she started laughing. She thought it was the funniest thing she'd heard. No one would laugh now. They understand animal abuse is a serious issue, and I think they respect people who have concern about it. I think the vegetarian issue is still contentious. It's not discussed as much as I would like, but there's certainly tensions around events that come up, whether vegetarian food will be served or not food. Certainly veganism is even more contentious. But I do think that more feminists are aware of those issues and supportive. So I think that some of the actions of PETA have People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals have alienated us somewhat from the feminist movement. But by and large, I'd say we're moving in the right direction.
Have you got anything you would like to say to our community? Anything further?
Well, I would just encourage people to look at the literature on ecofeminism and animal advocacy. My own work, and Carol Adams has also done a lot of work in this area, looking at abuse of animals from a feminist perspective, and to really realize this is a feminist issue. There is a connection between the domination of women and the domination of nature and animals. In my book, I refer to animals as other than human animals as a reminder that we are animals. You know, we're not exceptions to that.
We do forget.
We do forget. Mm-hmm. Our biology classes are there to remind us, thankfully. And I encourage people to explore veganism. I think it's something you can do every day to affirm our connection with other living beings, to disengage from patriarchal forms of violence. There's a little effort at the beginning when you're making the transition, but over time, it gets easier and easier, and after a while, it just feels like the norm.
It does. I can relate to that. Marty, thank you so much for coming in. Your book, Nature Ethics, An Ecofeminist Perspective, I'm sure is absolutely amazing. I've read some snippets and I need to go and read the whole lot. There is a website. You do have a website?
Yes, it's natureethics.com.
So if you want to hear more about Marty Keel, you can Google. I did Google. There's a lot on you on the internet, Marty. And definitely pick up Nature Ethics, An Ecofeminist Perspective. You've been listening to Joy 94.9. Thank you, Marty.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.